most harmful white guardist elements. As he further put it, when certain people, who may even be guided by the best possible motives, begin to sow panic just at the time when we are carrying out a retreat beset with vast difficulties, at a time when it is vitally important to retain good order in retreating, it is necessary to punish severely, ruthlessly, the slightest violation of discipline. Rather than spreading the workers' revolution abroad and throughout the world in 1921, Lenin now turned to the Western liberal democracies for help. And through a quirk of history, the man who Lenin turned to save his fledgling nation from mass starvation and poverty was none other than the American named Herbert Hoover. In an 1893 speech in New York's Union Square, Emma Goldman had urged the hungry poor to demonstrate before the palaces of the rich, demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread. Without the capitalists growing rich on the backs of the workers, the argument went, there would be plenty of food for everyone. Yet the capitalists were crushed in Russia, and there remained plenty of hunger for everyone. In 1914, Herbert Hoover had been a businessman living in London who had gotten involved with a very peculiar crisis. Belgium was under German occupation, with the food produced there being largely requisitioned for the German army. Great Britain, on the other hand, had imposed an economic blockade on German territory to make sure no aid reached her opponents. Hoover, via his commission for relief in Belgium, managed to negotiate with both warring sides in order to keep the Belgian population from starving. Hoover's monumental achievement caught the attention of people the world over. In 1917, the federal government set up the United States Food Administration to manage the supply and distribution of food throughout the United States, both to make sure everyone, especially everyone in the armed forces, would have access to food, but also to make sure that wartime hoarding and profiteering would be eliminated or, at the very least, kept to a minimum. Given his success in feeding Belgium, President Wilson naturally tasked Herbert Hoover with running the organization. Though his name later became synonymous with Republican apathy, it was Hoover who was utterly apathetic about publicly joining the GOP in 1920. The great engineer did so only because he saw the Republicans' electoral prospects were brighter that year than the Democrats were. Even a fool could see that 1920 would be a watershed year for the Republicans, and though Hoover was many things, a fool was not one of them. After recapturing the Senate in 1918, the Republicans picked up an additional 10 seats in 1920, winning every single contest outside of the Solid South. The House results were even more lopsided, with the GOP solidifying control of the chamber 303 to 131. The crown jewel was the White House, and the electoral result was a complete bloodbath. The year 1920 had started with Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Roosevelt writing to a colleague that, "I've had some nice talks with Herbert Hoover before he went west for Christmas. He is certainly a wonder, and I wish we could make him President of the United States." Months later, and despite some feelers from the stroked-out incumbent sitting in the Oval Office, the Democrats nominated Ohio Governor James M. Cox on the 44th ballot with FDR as his running mate. Opposing him was sitting United States Ohio Senator Warren G. Harding. It was then quite unusual for a senator to be nominated for the presidency, and no one had ever been elected to the White House directly from the Senate before. Harding ended up winning the election 60% to 34%, a bigger popular vote landslide than Teddy Roosevelt's in 1904, and the biggest since James Monroe ran basically unopposed for re-election in 1820. Harding appointed Hoover as Secretary of Commerce, but allowed him to maintain his role as Program Director of the American Relief Administration, the successor to his United States Food Administration. Now, however, the organization was tasked with feeding the starving nations of war-torn Europe. Hoover had previously attempted to help feed Russia in 1919, but Lenin knew that foreign aid invariably came with a price and refused what he regarded as foreign meddling in Russia's affairs. As a young man, Lenin had witnessed the effects of famine firsthand. In 1891, a combination of a dry autumn and a brutally cold winter caused the death of many seedlings in Russia. Those that remained were blown away by an unusually windy spring in 1892. Hundreds of thousands of people starved to death, and the hated Tsar was held to blame. Now, history is repeating itself in the exact same areas, only this time it was Lenin who reigned over a mother Russia, unable to feed her children. At first, Lenin refused to acknowledge that there was a problem, and he even forbade the media from using the words famine and starvation. But banning the discussion of starvation did nothing to alleviate hunger, and despite unofficial, scattered relief efforts, the problem only increased. Russians headed to their train stations in hopes of receiving food or being able to go to where some food was, but the gatherings turned to scenes of utter inhumanity. Starvation is a very curious thing, for before starvation consumes an individual, they often engage in ways completely incomprehensible in better times. Lenin's hometown was Simbirsk, and this is where one aid worker saw the unimaginable. Nursing babies have lost their voices and are no longer able to cry. Every day, more than 20 dead are carried away, but it's not possible to remove all of them. Sometimes corpses remain among the living for more than 5 days. A woman tries to soothe the small child lying in her lap. The child cries. For some time, the mother goes on rocking it in her arms. Then suddenly she strikes it. The child screams anew. This seems to drive the woman mad. She begins to beat it furiously, her face distorted with rage. She rains blows with her fist on its little face on its head, and at last she throws it upon the floor and kicks it with her foot. A murmur of horror rises around her. The child is lifted from the ground. Curses are hurled at the mother, who, after her furious excitement has subsided, has again become herself, utterly indifferent to everything around her. Her eyes are fixed, but are apparently sightless. By 1921, Lenin's political position was far more secure than in 1919. Yes, accepting aid from the United States would be humiliating, and yes, it would be thrown in his face as evidence of the failure of communism to feed the people. Yet it was precisely Lenin's fanatical ideology that permitted him to engage in public acts of great humility. It was the revolution and the people that mattered far more than him. While at first insisting that one must punish Hoover, one must publicly slap his face so the whole world sees how dare he try to keep millions from starving, by the summer of 1921, Lenin was persuaded to accept help from abroad. He would only do so with a major caveat left unstated publicly. For Lenin, the main thing is to identify and mobilize the maximum number of communists who know English to introduce them into the Hoover Commission and for other forms of surveillance. If the Americans were up to something, Lenin would know. If anyone should have been suspicious, it was Herbert Hoover and his team. Eventually, they had to pull out of their relief efforts after discovering the Bolsheviks were simply taking the grain and selling it for export. The rebellions in towns rife with starvation throughout the country were put down with complete mercilessness, with more than one village being razed and all its inhabitants slaughtered. At least 1 million people died, and almost certainly far more. But all this terror and suffering was a mere practice run for what was to come in the following decade. On the morning of May 26, 1922, Lenin got out of bed in a very ill state. His doctor was summoned and immediately knew what had happened. Although he was only 52 years of age, Vladimir Lenin had had a stroke. Though not in particular danger physically, the mental consequences were far more worrying to the Bolshevik leader. Lenin now had trouble walking and moving his arm. He also found himself unable to write, and even basic multiplication became too much for Lenin to handle. Recalling the suicide pact that Karl Marx's son-in-law had made and fulfilled with his wife in 1911, Lenin asked his own wife to deliver him cyanide. Unable to go through with it, the couple instead decide to send for one man who they felt certain was cold-blooded enough to go through with helping Lenin commit suicide, Joseph Stalin. The man who became known as Joseph Stalin was born as Yosef Djugashvili in what is now the country of Georgia in 1870. For various legal and cultural reasons, many of the revolutionary Bolsheviks had to operate under pseudonyms at the time. Fake names allowed them to write articles without fear of getting caught and to travel internationally without detection. Lenin himself was born as Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, for example. Leon Trotsky was Lev Bronstein, which allowed him to marginally obscure his Jewish roots, a major issue in violently anti-Semitic Russia. So did the name Stalin serve to make Djugashvili seem more Russian. Not only that, but he sounded downright heroic, as Stalin translated to man of steel. Yet despite the heroic moniker, Stalin's actions in joining the early Bolshevik party were unambiguously villainous. As Soviet historian Roy Medvedev recounted Stalin's early revolutionary activities, to Stalin belongs the dubious honor not only of participating in, but organizing several major terrorist acts, or as they were then called, expropriations, X's for short. These consisted mainly of armed robberies of banks, mail coaches, and steamships. The Bolsheviks considered such actions permissible at the time as a means of replenishing the party treasury, buying weapons, and making an impact on the Tsarist administration. Especially famous was the 1907 robbery of the Tiflis State Bank, which brought more than 300,000 rubles into the Bolshevik coffers. The X was carried out by a group of fighters including Kamo, the alias of S.A. Terpetrosian, but Stalin and Leonid Krasin organized and planned the operation. The organization of such actions required of Stalin not only cold-bloodedness, craftiness, and ruthlessness, but also links with the criminal world of Georgia. Many acts of expropriation were accompanied by human losses, but these were killings in the interest of the cause. By 1920, Stalin managed to hold a good amount of power within the Bolshevik party, having had various roles over the years, including editing the prominent journal Pravda, Russian for truth. But Stalin was nowhere near as influential as, say, Trotsky had been when it came to the development of Marxist ideology, especially as applied to the Russian Revolution. Trotsky knew very well how brilliant and important he was, and this had the inevitable consequence of rubbing many party members the wrong way. Stalin kept somewhat to the background and worked party members in order to build personal support. Per his wishes, Stalin did come visit the stroke-ridden Lenin, and he apparently promised to put Lenin out of his misery if things ever reached that point. But Stalin also managed to convince Lenin that suicide would be premature. No one doubted that Lenin was a fighter, and now he fought hard to regain his faculties. Yet even the great Vladimir Lenin could only do so much, and that December saw Lenin fall victim to two minor strokes, followed by another major one. Lenin would never write another word until the day that he died. Lenin again sent word to Stalin pleading to be put out of his misery. One can only imagine how awkward taking the dying Lenin's dictation must have been, but Stalin again refused. Soviet Russia had been Lenin's vision, and he had been the driving force of remaking the country in line with the edicts of Marxist dialectical materialism. But now that he was incapacitated, there arose the question of who should replace the man who even his enemies admitted was entirely unique and irreplaceable. Lenin's incapacitation led to a major change in Soviet history. He had subscribed to the idea of a worldwide workers' revolution, country by country. Stalin, on the other hand, envisioned a union of Soviet socialist republics, a country where formerly independent states would be subsumed under one new nation heavily centralized in Moscow. For Lenin and many others, especially the Ukrainians and Stalin's native Georgians, this was unconscionable and harkened back to Russian nationalism of the worst kind. In a sense, both men got their way. The USSR was proclaimed on December 28, 1922, including delegates from Ukraine, Belarusia, and Transcaucasia, in addition to Russia herself. On paper, the various republics still had a great deal of autonomy, but this would quickly fall away and control increasingly took place within Moscow. As Lenin recuperated, the Soviet Union was run by a troika consisting of Stalin, Lev Kamenev, and Grigory Zinoviev. Stalin took control of Lenin's living arrangements when his health reached a point of no return. The man he trusted with his death, Lenin now had no choice but to trust with his life. Stalin strictly controlled who could visit and what sort of correspondence would go in or out. He wouldn't have been able to do these things to Lenin if Lenin weren't stuck in a wheelchair. But Lenin was. He was in that chair, and he was effectively Stalin's prisoner with no recourse or means of reaching the outside world. It was on January 21, 1924, that Vladimir Lenin took his last breath without needing Stalin's assistance at all. His faculties at the end were a mere shadow of those which had completely rewritten world history less than a decade prior. This left the Soviet Union at a crossroads. Would it continue the vision as a beacon of hope around the earth, inspiring revolution within one nation after another? Or would the focus become more internal? Stalin strongly favored the latter view, campaigning on a vision of socialism in one country. On the other side, far more in line with the ideas of Marx and Lenin, remained Leon Trotsky and his followers. As is so often the case, an argument over philosophy served as a convenient pretext to obscure a raw power struggle. Kamenev and Zinoviev continued to side with Stalin against Trotsky, and slowly but surely the Bolshevik visionary was driven from his seats of power without Lenin to protect him. Nor did Trotsky have an enormous amount of support within the Communist Party itself. The man who understood Marxist politics perhaps better than anyone alive had a fairly poor appreciation for party politics. Niceties and schmoozing were not his forte, to put it mildly, and it cost him dearly. Though if he was more of a raw politician and less of an ideologue, he would not have been Trotsky to begin with. By 1927, Stalin succeeded in expelling Trotsky from the Communist Party, and by early 1928, he was expelled from the Soviet Union itself. Trotsky was no longer welcome in the very country he had been instrumental in creating. He settled at first in Turkey as Stalin further consolidated power and plotted to eliminate his one-time rival from the face of the earth. For his part, the loquacious Trotsky had no shortage of thoughts about how the revolution was betrayed and why things in the Soviet Union seemed to have gone so horribly wrong. Life remained difficult in the USSR for years after the Russian Civil War had been won by the Bolsheviks. Housing became even more of a concern as rural citizens flocked to the rapidly industrializing cities in search of work and food. Families became crammed into apartments that had already been occupied by other families, and both eviction and trying to find a new place to live effectively became impossible. Some of this was by design in keeping with communist ideology. The ultimate vision was to have homes without kitchens so that everyone would eat communally in government-run cafeterias. True believer communist architects designed buildings where everyone would have to share bathrooms as well as part of an assault on bourgeois concepts such as shame, privacy, and individualism. This created an enormous incentive for families to turn in those living with them to the authorities for the most specious of reasons, if not downright lies. One phone call and the living quarters for one's family instantly doubled. What's the harm? If they weren't guilty of one thing, then surely they were guilty of another. And if they hadn't done anything, then they would have nothing to fear from the Cheka, right? This became such a commonplace occurrence that it was even joked about in popular magazines at the time. Just think, Masha, how unpleasant I wrote a denunciation of Galkin, and it turns out that Balkin has the bigger room. As bad as housing was, the food issue was even worse. In part, this was due to the difficulties of production and distribution, but in part, this was also by design, and Stalin's war in Ukraine remains one of the most horrific episodes in 20th century history. It all began with the first five-year plan in 1928, a reversal of Lenin's NEP policies and a return to a socialist, planned approach to the economy. Part of this plan was an increased focus on collectivization of the farmland. Instead of farmers being allowed to work their own land and hand over some of what they produced to the state, the goal was to combine plots into giant enterprises under government control. The theory was that collectivized farms would be more efficient and productive. This would allow for more grain to be exported, which in turn could be used to finance greater industrialization in the rest of the Soviet Union. The main opponents to this plan were the larger and wealthier farmers known as the kulaks. The liquidation of the kulaks was the plan to shatter their place in society, and the primary target of this liquidation was the Ukraine, invariably described as the breadbasket of Europe due to its fertile lands. The kulaks themselves were treated in one of several ways. Those most dangerous to the state received prison sentences or were even executed. Some were deported deep into the Soviet Union, with almost 2 million people being moved in the years 1930 to 31 alone. Others were simply kicked off their land and out of their native villages. Anyone opposing such moves was invariably regarded as either kulak themselves or a kulak sympathizer, which was little better. Yet being reduced to serfs of the state was a bridge too far, not just for the kulaks, but for much of the peasantry. It was too reminiscent of those worst aspects of czarism that they had bitterly fought against for decades. As the amount of grain demanded by the Bolsheviks increased, so did the defiance of the farmers. Land was abandoned. Farm animals were slaughtered for meat and hides rather than being handed over to the government with nothing to show for it. Some state officials were met with violence, and riots occurred several times as peasants were forced to hand over the fruits of their labor. The concept was that under socialism, without either the kulaks to exploit the peasants or the capitalist class to seize unearned value in the form of profits, every year would see increases in production. This might perhaps make sense in a factory setting, as workers better learned the necessities of their roles and figured out ways to produce more efficiently. When it came to agriculture, this was virtually impossible, since so much of production was dependent on the changing weather. The year 1930 had been a very favorable one for crops, while the year 1931 had far worse conditions. Nevertheless, the government quotas remained the same. This was close to an impossibility, but the dekulakization only made it worse. By eliminating so many who had managed the larger farms, the Bolsheviks had thereby also eliminated a great deal of technical farming expertise. Collectivized farm animals had no one personally responsible for them and little to feed them with besides. The newfound state serfdom resulted in work slowdowns and stoppages as an ongoing form of protest. Not only was no one working, but the Communist Party of Ukraine had to admit that many of the workers weren't even getting paid. Official Soviet figures admitted that the harvest requisitions had fallen from 7.7 million tons from the total 1930 harvest of 23.9 million tons to 7.2 million tons from the 1931 harvest of 18.3 million tons. Hungry peasants had no choice but to consume the grain they would otherwise have saved in the following year, which already guaranteed that the 1932 harvest would be a disaster. To make matters worse, much of the grain that was requisitioned was being exported instead of being used to feed the Soviet citizenry. In the summer of 1932, an edict came from on high. Reaffirming that public property is the basis of the Soviet system, it therefore somewhat logically followed that those attempting to steal public property must be considered enemies of the people. It concluded by legally equating stored grain as state property, and those who stole this newfound state property as a punitive measure, the highest measure of social defense, execution. The law left some leeway, allowing for a prison sentence of no fewer than 10 years. In capitalist America, Emma Goldman had urged the hungry workers to take food. In Soviet Russia, hunger now became grounds for the death penalty. December 1932 saw the reintroduction of another despised law. One of the most frequent criticisms of socialists against the Tsar was the internal passport system, used to keep track of who went where in Russia. Starvation was now causing even more people to flee from the countryside to the cities, leaving fewer behind to work the land and further perpetuating the problem. Stalin revived internal passports, which allowed for more efficient deportation of both individuals and populations, as well as de facto trapping people in the villages where they were. Travel within the Soviet Union became a matter of permission, not a right, but it also became a punishment. As historian S.J. Taylor wrote, "Victims about to be deported were stripped of their shoes, and their clothes were taken and given to lower peasants as a bribe to ensure their cooperation. Kulak children were left as beggars on the street. Those transported to Siberia faced insuperable hardship. If a village existed, they were squeezed into it. Otherwise, they were simply abandoned without shelter in extreme cold and ordered to build dwellings. Many managed to do so by working almost around the clock without sleep in order that they and the others would not freeze to death. Those employed as forced labor in mining regions faced starvation rations of one bowl of thin gruel a day and 8 to 10 ounces of bread. They died in waves, their numbers replenished by the arrival of new deportees." The passport system was reintroduced alongside a program of urban registration. The passports included name, age, sex, nationality, and social position. Only approved persons were allowed to reside within cities. When the secret police registered everyone, they made it a point to expel any kulaks or those who were otherwise disenfranchised. This created an enormous incentive for people to renounce their class origins or other affiliations, though often to little avail. Like something out of Exodus, government-approved activists descended onto the Ukraine's villages like a biblical plague in the winter of 1932-33. Everything that was edible they were to take, and they were given special tools to make sure that every nook and